attention the so-called EH antenna. There were a number of proposals to build a broadcast antenna where inside the antenna there were structures that were generating E, there were other structures that were generating H, and by doing it as a separate operation, the claim was being made that the antenna was going to be extremely broadband, very low in Q, very high in efficiency, and launching waves into space. And from my point of view, and after reading a bunch of articles about the so-called EH antenna, I came to the conclusion that it was a great sounding idea on paper, but it didn't work, or at least with the methods that were being used at that time, it wasn't working. So any method to try to treat E or H separately within a structure, I can sort of understand that, but once you launch the wave into free air, you're going to have a very specific ratio between E and H, and the propagating wave in air is going to have this TEM characteristic, and no other characteristic will propagate. So I'm therefore wondering what...
To the point. Separation and trying to be somehow minimize or diminish the influence of each H field to E field.
Okay. One possible understanding of what Maxwell has been trying to tell us with his equations is that whenever you have a rate of change of H field, whether you want to or not, you're generating a corresponding magnitude of E field, and vice versa. So when E field is changing, it's making H. When H field is changing, it's making E. And one of those I'm having a little trouble with. A changing H field generating E, I accept that one. Whether or not a changing E field would generate H, that's a function of how you do it and where the current is flowing, and really, by a mysterious means, you're really generating H. So any rate of change of H with nearby sensing structures that are usually conductors will generate an E by Faraday's law. So what is going to be gained by treating E and H separately within the antenna if ultimately you have to launch it into space and there's a very specific free space impedance characteristic between E and H that you must obey on the launch, on the wave that you launch that you want to propagate. So the good news about magnetic materials is that you can change them electronically fairly fast by saturation effects. Whereas with E-field effects, it's much more difficult to do that. I think a Bragg cell does it. I believe a Bragg cell changes apparent dielectric constant electronically. But I think it's a very expensive and difficult structure. And is it electronic tuning that is being desired here? Rapid electronic tuning of the lensing effect. Is that the overall thrust of this concept, to your knowledge, OS? N2XJN, K2RIW?
N2XJN. Basically, it's not really about the antenna. It's about ability to play with H and E field and create a pattern that can have not so simple magnetic field orientation, which varies in space. So the sheet or rod of the magnetic material may then ideally need to be tapered in thickness and bent in shape to match that field or pattern. So basically, it is addressed to certain geometrical ideas, and although it might sound that it's non-realistic, it's a scientific paper, it's the second one. The first one was touching the subject of the subject of playing with the principles of Maxwell's equation. Let me drop. It's like a certain requisite of dielectric and magnetic media. Well, the paper, this particular states, and another matter. Another matter. That's what it says at the end of it. Why the geometry introduce additional possibilities all, one still needs to have a practical materials which may be somehow undesirable with the limitations. But then, if we go to the link number 3 that I have sent you, and before that link, right at the bottom of that link says interactive graph. In your email, you have interactive graph that is showing a dipping on domain wall. And this is this was taken from the Wikipedia. You see what's going on with the domain under the influence of H field. The reason that I put all together is because I want to go to one particular link and show it to you. But do you see this graph, interactive graph, or the moving graph on your email?
Yes, I do see the interactive graph, AND, interacting graph. I see the moving arrow. I see the H field wrapping around a rod. The depinning of a domain wall, non-magnetic inclusions in the volume, and so on. So the H field, when propagating past that, which I guess is a round ferrite rod viewed end view, the magnetic field for a period of time wraps around that rod, and I presume that wave is propagating to the right in that picture. Is that true, Greg?
Correct. But it's also related to the certain defects. Let's say, if you read that, dislocation in a crystallographic structure that can conping.
Underneath the paragraph says a non-magnetic inclusions in the volume of a ferromagnetic material or dislocations in crystallography structure can cause pinning of the domain walls, see animation. Such pinning sites cause the domain wall to seat in a local energy minimum, and external field is required to unpin the domain wall from the pinned position. The act of unpinning will cause sudden magnetic hysteresis. No.
Sudden movement of the domain wall and sudden change of the volume of both neighboring domains. This causes Barkhausen noise effect. That's what you mentioned in one of the segments.
Yeah, that so-called clicking noise that was being observed. Was this what was causing that clicking noise? So the pinned down domains that were suddenly moving, or the magnetic domains that were orienting themselves in the presence of the bar magnet being moved, was, I guess, being picked up by a coil somewhere in the structure that went to an amplifier, and you heard a clicking noise as those individual domains moved, I guess is what's going on here.
With your own words, describe that interactive graph?
Yeah, they describe it as pinning. I see that there's a kind of delay of the H field because of that dark rod-like structure, and the H field sort of hangs onto the rod for a while and then snaps away from it. It's the best way I can explain it. So it is a kind of a snap-back operation. It's almost like an inductive kickback, but that's not really what it is.
And you can do it with your finger as well.
I don't know what you mean by I can do it with my finger.
You hold your finger with another hand, and then you rapidly remove that force. The finger go fast. So the picture of acceleration after it passed is stronger. Is faster.
Is this believed to be a mechanism by which you change velocity of propagation or increase energy?
I believe. What I believe. And then, right on the top of that interactive, I have a link says www umbrella, and then you click on it, now you're going to see something that might have some very easy to understand English because it was translated, but now you have a structure and three. In this structure you have three different examples, and this is by the inventor Melnichenko, the Russian. You have again the sandwich, and then on the right graph is that pink represented. When we pin, then we actually separate for this particular moment the E field from the H field. In other words, we're playing with the back EMF. I don't know how to say it, but whatever you see, back to you.
I see this one page diagram, which was done 14 July 2011. At Latvia Riga, document formed in Latvia Riga. And it looks like dielectric and ferrite rings alternated with south-north, south-north, and various thicknesses of dielectric. So is this a toroid-like structure in cross-section that I'm
correct? So we need only a high frequency generator to do two things at the same time. Modulate at high frequency, and by moving it, let's say we get 50 hertz of usable electric frequency, resulting by these two factors, magnetic domains will cause to spin and produce a strong magnetic field that is not independent from the back EMF. Because we won't will not have the magnetic field around all ferromagnetic rings. This is basically what I'm driving to, Dick.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what the intent is.
The intent is that if you don't have a back EMF, then you have a hell of a lot of power.
Okay. The word back EMF is something I associate with what's sometimes called magnetic kickback. If I've got current flowing through a coil, like say for instance I put my ohm meter on the low scale to the primary of a power transformer, and the needle moves over kind of slowly as you're charging the magnetic field into that transformer, and eventually a certain magnetic field is built up, the thing settles down, and you measure the number of ohms of the primary winding. At the instant you disconnect the source of current, the volt-ohm milliammeter, the magnetic field begins to collapse, and you get a back EMF. People call it an inductive kickback. Any rate of change of magnetic field in the presence of a loop of conducting material will, by Faraday's law, induce a voltage in that conducting material. And so, if that's the back EMF, I don't know how you can avoid that. In other words, are we looking for a method of skirting around Faraday's law? That if I've got a loop of conductor, like a copper ring, and if the area inside of the ring has a magnetic field that is changing, Faraday's law dictates how many volts will be induced into that copper ring. And so any collapsing magnetic field is going to give an inductive kickback. I'm not quite sure why we want to avoid that, and are we trying to circumvent Faraday's law?
Correct.
Why are we trying to circumvent Faraday's law? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
I'm with Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, if we eliminate the counter electromotive force, the current will try to go to infinity, from what I understand. So what is the purpose of this?
Okay, if I've got a very low resistance solenoid coil of wire, and if I've got a ferrite material inside of it, I have a certain inductance. I put an AC wave across there. Because the inductance gives me a certain amount of inductive reactance, I get a small amount of current that flows. as I extract that ferrite rod, the inductance of the coil decreases, the inductive reactance at that fixed frequency decreases, and the current will start climbing very high. I can make a high current by putting a certain amount of AC voltage across a coil that has very little inductance. I'm not quite sure how that gives me an advantage yet. Back to you, John. K2LIW.
The power.
I didn't catch what Wesley just commented on, but all I know is if we have a coil and we apply AC, the limiting factor is the counter-electric motor force, which totally limits the amount of current that coil will draw at that specific voltage. And if we eliminate that, again, I don't understand the purpose of even trying to eliminate it. But what experiment are we doing this for? What are we trying to achieve?
I can say what we're trying to achieve. I was touching the subject of ferroresonance. And ferroresonance is nonlinear resonance in complex of electrical phenomena, which may cause overvoltages and overcurrents in electrical power systems. And those, the in transmission parts, the switch gears, you know, ferroresonance overvoltages on the electric power system may recognize and investigated since 1930. Now, it occurs that when nonlinear inductor is fed from series capacitor, let me jump, the nonlinear inductor can be due to the magnetic core of the wound-tap voltage transformer, or it may be due to the complex structure of the three-phase transformer. The circuit capacitance can be due to the number of elements, such the circuit capacitor or parallel lines, conductor to the earth capacitor, circuit breakers, grinding capacitor, and so on. My understanding is that by number of the articles that I put in this email, we at least have something that for me looks somehow real. The high voltage excitation on the ferrite core causes saturation of the core into enhanced domain spin, let me drop it, which causes an electrostatic effect in the surrounding ambient. This causes standing waves. The increase of kinetic energy potential of the ambient electron energy, which manifests as powerful magnetic flux without hardly any input energy required. So the it looks like the expected coefficient of performance might be more than 100. At least that's what this page of that the last page stands for. It's a Russian inventor who is playing with that. So in order to balance the phase and the dipole needs, the coil appears to be moving with the respect to the magnetic flux that impinges a current on the coil. So there is no resonance as to say to be in it, but more excitation of the and it's not parametric. So the load is pulled on the opposite side of the dipole as kind of free of back EMF energy. That I can say. Back to you.
Okay, I'm getting the impression now that one of the goals of this research is seeking techniques where the transfer of energy is greater than 100%, more energy out than going in. And by backing EMF control and magnetic field control, the researchers are seeking that. And one of the main things that I worry about, and that when I've seen many of the previous Wikipedias that seem, or YouTube videos and things like, YouTube videos that seem to show greater than unity transfer of a rotary machine and magnetic mechanism, is that the people doing the work were making the mistake of not using true RMS voltmeters and true RMS current meters. Whenever magnetic saturation, let me drop it.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, whenever magnetic saturation occurs, you get some extremely nonlinear waveforms. And when you've got a nonlinear waveform of voltage or current, you can evaluate its peak, its average, but one of the most important things energy-wise is true RMS. A very nonlinear waveform on a true RMS meter will give you an extremely different current reading or voltage reading than an ordinary averaging meter. And so because of the one kind of nonlinearity on the input power to a machine and another kind of nonlinearity on the output, if you're using ordinary averaging meters, you will think you're seeing greater than unity. It is my belief that if they were using true RMS instrumentation, where the true RMS could handle all of the frequencies involved. You got to be careful about the word true RMS. Every true RMS meter has a frequency and rate of rise and a DVDT or DIDT beyond which it no longer gives the correct answer. So you've got to use the right kind of true RMS meter in order to really evaluate what power is going in and what power is coming out. And once you do it with a true RMS manner, is my guess that many of the greater than unity machines might turn out to be less than unity. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, you had a question.
Yeah, I completely agree, Dick. I think that power measurement is something that, you know, it has to be looked at very, very careful, all of its components, and then, of course, you know, taking into effect the power factor and, you know, what's actually VARs, what's really true power. And, you know, some of those measurements can be very, very difficult to make and very, very prone to error. Just one other interesting comment here was the discussion about back EMF. In the case of an inductor, when it's charged or when you're putting current into the inductor and it's building up a magnetic B field around the outside of that coil, and then as you reduce the current or open it, basically the magnetic field collapses, as you said before, and the energy returns back into electrical energy in the coil. Let me let it drop for 1 second. The point that I was getting to here is that when you drive the coil with a low enough impedance such that you're always driving the AC current into a forward direction such that the current will build a varying delta B field, then from that point, you're basically overpowering the reverse EMF. In that particular point, that's when the coil starts to radiate and electromagnetic energy starts to leave from the coil. So, all is accounted for. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, if you look at that one-page paper, and you look at the image, the last image at the bottom, then you see that what they're trying to achieve with that sandwich like ferrite and insulators, it just move the magnetic field halfway towards the right. Do you see that?
I believe you're describing image 1.2, IMG 1.2, is that correct? Now, part of what John said earlier and what I think you're saying, Wesley, is that you seem to be considering back EMF as something that is undesirable. I'm not convinced it's undesirable. I think whenever a magnetic field is being charged by a coil of wire around that magnetic structure, in the beginning a significant amount of back EMF is created, and therefore the amount of current that flows in the beginning is less. But energy is being stored in the coil. Anyhow, the rate at which magnetic field is being built up determines the rate of back EMF, and I'm not considering back EMF undesirable. It's just something that's the real world. It's got to be there. It's just one of the directions in which you use Faraday's law, and I don't think we should be trying to avoid it. Any method that tries to avoid back EMF, I think, will stop you from building up a magnetic field.
Yeah, but Dick, what would happen if you are able to move halfway to the right, the magnetic field? Would that be the domain it will cause the spin to produce strong magnetic field that is independent from back EMF?
Between image 1.1 and 1.2, I see a second arrow moving to the right. I see within the black squares a bunch of dotted lines, which I presume represent the shifting of a magnetic field to the right.
Right.
What is causing that shifting of the magnetic field to the right?
Well, they were trying to apply the modulation. So they have a high-frequency form, rings like modulated. They were trying to refer to modulated laser tubes. And with that modulated frequency, they could move these rings across. That's what is happening. With a laser tubes, you are able to actually lens the energy to the desired place in free space. That's why I brought all of these papers together, just to ask you the final question. What would happen if we would be able to move that magnetic field to the right? As the paper that we see is, well, an inventor who actually put that patent into the Russian patent office and to exist.
Yeah, I'm still studying the words that are under those two images. I'm not yet sure why we desire to move the magnetic field to the right. Is it a magnetic equivalent of a laser-like action that we're seeking?
That's right. In other words, they were trying to force the domains to spin and the magnetic field in the domains to produce a strong magnetic field that is independent from the back EMF. And what he says is that when is that happening, then we have usable electric energy.
QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Definition of a strong electromagnetic field free from its back EMF is a radiated electromagnetic field. So he's basically just talking about radiated energy. I don't have the document in front of me, but I guess I failed to see where radiated energy is creating any new or anything above originally what's being generated. Let me pass first back to you, the K2RW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of a laser, you have the so-called charging pump assembly. You've got this light-emitting device with just the right wavelength on the outside of the lacing material, which favors the particular electrons going around those molecules, around those atoms of the lacing material. It kicks them into a higher energy orbit around their nucleus. And when they jump back down, apparently they don't do it for the most part spontaneously. It takes something to trigger them to make them jump back down, but by way of the mirrors on the two ends and the resonant length between the two, eventually a wave gets created which stimulates all of those charged molecules to jump down all in synchronization. And so even though you're charging it for a significant length of time, you get all the energy back out in an extremely small piece of time because of the way those excited molecules jump back to their basic state. That's my understanding of the stimulated emission phenomena within a laser. I'm getting the impression that this author is trying to do a similar thing with magnetics.
If you recall magnetic lensing, ferromagnetic lensing, what he's trying to use is use similar technique to Mr. Baum, who has absolutely a beautiful history in science, just to push that magnetic field, just to play like the Baum was trying to play with E field and H field.
I think he's saying he's trying to create a coherent magnetic field.
I'm not sure. There's not quite enough diagram and words for me to quite catch on to what's going on this one page document by Latvia Riga. Were you able to, when you look, John, at that that one page document, the bottom is labeled document affirmed, AFFORMDD, affirmed, I'm not familiar with that word, not affirmed, affirmed, in Latvia Riga, 14 of July 2011. Were you able to understand what that diagram is showing, John?
Not fully, Dick. It would be unfair because I just took a cursory view of that whole email structure that he sent, and I was just listening to the conversation to try to find out what is the purpose and what are they trying to achieve. Wesley couldn't give me that in that short discussion we had before the net.
Yeah, we get a little bit of a hint from the top of the page. It says, step-by-step guide to free energy lesson NR2. So it does sound like these guys are seeking a way of getting more energy out of a machine that you put in, and that hopefully they're trying to do it continuously, not just as an impulse. And by moving magnetic fields and changing back EMF, I think they're hoping to do that. But if they're getting any kind of nonlinearity of current, voltage, magnetic field, whatever, and if they're not making their measurements with high enough frequency capable true RMS instrumentation, then based on what I've seen on some of those past YouTube videos, I know it's very easy to fool yourself because of the difference between average measurements and true RMS measurements. And so I'm led to believe that some of these excess energy phenomena might not continue to exist when the right kind of measurements are made. In order to really figure out input energy and output energy, you have to instantaneously be multiplying voltage times current to figure out what was the input energy, and the same thing when it comes to the output energy. To do it fast enough in a true RMS manner, measuring voltage and current and the product of the two with the phase angle between them in order to calculate what was the real energy input per cycle, so to speak, if it's a cyclic phenomenon. The words roll off the tongue easily. To really do it in a way that's traceable to the Bureau of Standards, that's another whole issue.
A question for you, Dick and Derek Sheehan. That graph was showing that the magnetic field is going around the pin and then snapping. So when you hold with one hand your finger and you release, you snap. Basically, you store the energy for the moment and then you release that. By using a high voltage, and I was also studying the high voltage generators. I didn't include that these links just didn't want it to complicate that matter. I believe there is something in it, but to not stay on this subject longer, there is a subject number two, which might be more interesting to you. Ball antenna. That's subject number two on your email. It introduces and combines properties of the balloon and antenna. But do you?
Yeah, snap action itself doesn't necessarily increase energy. I can stretch a rubber band, and while I'm stretching it, I'm putting in energy. Eventually, the rubber band breaks, and it snaps back. But in that experiment, although I get a lot of energy in a short period of time, the end of the rubber band might move very fast, slam against my finger, and give me a discomfort. But I'm not getting more energy out than I put in total just because there's a snap action. So that in itself doesn't do it. Inductive kickback doesn't give me an energy increase. A sudden breakdown of a high voltage circuit doesn't give me more energy out than I put in. The laser snap action, where I get a tremendous amount of pulse for a very short period of time, I'm not getting more energy out than I put in. So snap action itself, to me, doesn't necessarily represent energy increase.
I agree with you. As long as we don't find a way to play with the dependency between E-field and H-field, which actually number of researchers with the highly recognized names were trying to do.
Yeah, but there's a lot of danger in trying to separate E-field and H-field, treat them separately, and then bring them back together again to transmit a wave. I've seen people go down that road with that so-called EH antenna, and a lot of articles were written, a lot of proposals were written. There was a station in Holland that actually installed one, a broadcast station. It was believed to be low to the ground, high in performance, large in gain and whatever, and all of a sudden we don't hear anything about it, so I'm a little worried that it didn't do all that it was expected to do. So attempts to separate E and H, I think, are fraught with a lot of danger. The rate of change of magnetic field is going to induce an E-field. That's Faraday's law, and it's very... I don't think you can avoid it. I don't think there's a way around it. So you think you're treating E and H separately. As you can tell, I'm starting off skeptical. I'm not sure we can do that. I'm now moving down to subject number two, and which one of those things should I open on subject number two?
Posit the link right on the need of the subject number two, which is achieving impedance increase 4:1 over the feeding coax. And while you're looking at that, I give you some introduction. Bal antenna, BALANTENNA, combines the properties of the balloons and antenna. As a balloon in transmission, in steps up the voltage as 1:2 and impedance 1:4, with the important practical case of 50Q to 200Q. The antenna consists of two conical antennas, each of 100 watts characteristic impedance near the apex, connected in series via center assembly, which contains the choke, ferrite, or similar. Taking up. And it says that it led us to refer to this as the single apex design, since both asymptotic biocons share a common apex. The center assembly has the converging conductors and come back together smoothly outside the choke to preserve current continuity. The remaining two asymptotic cones, the outmost one from each biocon, connect the large antenna, which includes the 50Q coax, bringing the signal to the ball antenna. The coax being hidden as a part of the wormhole feed. Now, I have a problem even to read that. Let me up. What I'm trying to find out is the challenge of having this kind of structure and the benefits of utilizing it. Back to you.
I'm looking at figure 2.1, and as I see it, he has a coaxial cable. When I look at the right hand, the Bravo picture, not the Alpha, the Bravo, view a long axis from B toward A. Okay, I see that. So the center conductor of the coaxial cable is going into the left and right conic sections. The shield of the coaxial cable is going to the upper and lower conic sections. That's an unusual way of feeding a turnstile-like structure. normally the turnstile structure, the opposite cones are fed out of phase. He's feeding them in phase. I'm having a little trouble picturing how that's going to radiate. Now, this antenna, is this a bi-directional antenna? In other words, he's got this disc at the end of the transmission line with four triangular-shaped elements, and does it radiate from the right-hand picture? Does it radiate toward me and away from me? Is that the intent of the U.S.?
I do not understand it perfectly. That's why I send it to you. You discuss number of different antennas and transmission lines through the time that I'm on the TechNet. And I found that structure kind of very much unique. And I see that special transmission line through the center assembly. And it is going through the choke, and it's using it is being used to divide the signal in parallel from the feeding coax to two biocons. That I understand. But then I'm having a problem with the rest of it. I see that it combines properties of balloon and antenna. I see that it's able to have a transmission balloon 1 to 2 and impedance 1 to 4. Now, it does go with the impedance from 50 ohm to 200 ohm. And it consists two conical antennas. Each one is 100 watts. Says watts, W, characteristic impedance near the apex. And I see this asymptotic cones. Let me just... Then I know that this is kind of sensor and simulation, just trying to get along with this and try to understand it smoothly. Back to you.
Yeah, two conical antennas, each 100 watt characteristic impedance near the apex. You don't write characteristic impedance in units of watts, it's units of ohms. So I'm confused by that vocabulary. Was this translated? I guess Carl Baum, as you said, from the Phillips Laboratory, and Donald McLemore, probably...
Chris, it was cleared for public in 1994.
Okay. You know, for that matter, the quadrifilar helix antenna was also a classified antenna at one time. There are a lot of things that get classified that maybe didn't really deserve it. So, when I see the... Figure 2.1. I've almost figured out what's going on between the B picture and the A picture, but there's a portion of it that I haven't figured out. I see where the A cones and the B cones are wrapped around that ferrite disc, the tapered ferrite disc. But then in the A picture, I see antenna arm number 2 and antenna arm number 1. I don't know where antenna arm number 1 and antenna arm number 2 are going, and how do they differ from contacts A and contacts B. There's not enough picture here to picture the whole structure.
They have a certain uniformity that is distributed, the distributed current around the hole through the faces, and there is a certain wave of the flaring connection that could be adjusted to better match the desired characteristic impedances. So my understanding is, yes, we can play with the impedance in here based on the structure of that. I mean, if that helps.
Dick, could that W refer to the impedance in ohms mathematically?
Boy, that would be a very sure, a very poor use of the letters of the alphabet, if you know what I mean. To use W as impedance, W could be a poor man's equivalent of writing the word, the Greek letter omega, meaning frequency. But to use W for impedance, that would be crazy.
Okay, so let's say that it looks like original document, but let's say they meant omega.
But then the sentence would read, the antenna consists of two conical antennas, parentheses, each of 100 omega characteristic impedance near the apex. Still doesn't make sense.
I see here, the transmission line and the coax can be trimmed to allow parasitic effect so that signals arrive at phases A and B with exactly the same delay.
Interesting wording here. The remaining two asymptotic cones, the outermost one from each bicone, connect to the large antenna, which includes the 50-ohm coax bringing the signal to the bow antenna. This coax being hidden as part of the wormhole feed. Almost sounds a little bit like science fiction, doesn't it, John?
Absolutely. Very poor notations here. Now, the wormhole feed, I imagine they're talking about a concentric feed from one point of the antenna to the second point.
I don't see it this way. Wormhole means spiral increasing the diameter. It's like a wormhole. It's like vortex.
I think by him using the word wormhole feed, he's trying to say that the coax cable is in a neutral plane. It's not part of the antenna. And no signal gets excited on the outside shield of the coax cable, even though the outside shield is connected to two of the elements of the antenna. And that's a pretty good trick, because I don't see ferrite beads or any other kind of choking device on the coaxial feed. So I sure wish I had a photograph of the final product, as opposed to just schematic diagrams of little pieces of it, and he's expecting you to put it all together in your brain, even though he never shows it to you as one composite picture.
3.1 figure. 6.
I'm looking at page 6, I'm looking at 3.1, and my goodness, I don't think I'm seeing a complete picture. I don't know what I'm seeing, but I'm not getting the picture yet.
You have a coax on the left-hand side, you have antenna, arm, on the right-hand side. You have two ferrites on the top, and then you have a connection in the middle. Now, on the right-hand side, it shows you the circles, how the A is connected, and how it's looking A towards B. And then you have a cross-section right underneath of it. And then underneath of that you have three circles, cross-section D, cross-section E, and looking at B. You want to go to figure number 3, you see the interior details for the double apex, coaxial transmission line, two phases. That shows a little bit more, and on the right you have a plane cutoff of ferrite from, let's say, right-hand side. You're looking at that. There's something that shows comparison of an antenna characteristic. You look at the picture. The single apex design has some limitation on the high frequency performance based on the thickness of the center assembly. And they talk about simplified description, and it says, instead of a smooth curved intersection with a plane of constant phi in the cylindrical coordinate system, the approximate arcs by straight lines are indicated. The conical faces extend out and form the tapper back to where they match. For the convenience, the antenna arm portion are not included here, being described in previous illustration. So we can consider two rays going towards the infinity near z equals zero plane. And then the thickness of the center assembly travel an extra distance to around a certain assembly of the structure. And you have a full antenna on figure number 4-1. The spot difference of on asymmetry plane for a single apex design. Now on the figure number 4-3, you have basically the left antenna, the right antenna shown, and the center, which we already discussed, and it says is being called the double apex with the thin cones for certain assembly. Figure 4.3.
I'm going to agree with John where he said earlier that the 100W really meant somebody put W in by mistake. It should have been omega. So it's 100 ohm, 100 omega characteristic impedance near the apex. I think that's just a typo, if you know what I mean. Typewriters, you have to do something very special on a typewriter in order to print a Greek letter. And is the Greek omega and equal to a W? Maybe it is.
Yeah, but they use the English capital W. That's an error, but I think that's what it's construed to be.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think they meant a Greek omega there, and it printed as a W by mistake. So that's just a typo. And so he's got a pair of 100 ohm antennas, maybe in parallel, as that was giving 50 ohms, and the balloning structure is trying to couple 50 up to 200 to a voltage doubling phenomenon.
On page number 16, they relate to the impedance of each biocon, and they say that it is directly applicable to the present case with the flat faces for the center assembly. And then they go to the characteristic impedance of each biocon, then they go to trying to look at the case of interest with the flat faces for the center assembly. Okay. And then they have a graph, combination of angles for a given biocon impedance at page 17, and concluding remarks. This paper gives some design options for the ball antenna. From an antenna standpoint, the double apex is better than single apex. One may be considered about the fact that there are two phase centers and how one interprets that in terms of spherical wave. However, if we take the point of view that we are trying to approximate the plane wave, then this characteristic is not significant. The disadvantage of the double apex design should be contrasted with the added complexity associated with the transmission line passing through the center assembly. Some trade-off is called for achieve optimum performance. And then underneath is a number of reference, mostly from Mr. Baum, but some of them in regard to the same antenna from Mark Lemoore, Sauer, and Lattman. These names I've met before, very highly high quality scientists.
W2YY. Tech, I'd like to ask K2J a question, quick question before he hangs it up for the night.
I hope he's still there. Go ahead with your question.
K2AJ, you still tuned in over here?
We may also go to subgeometry, which is the design consideration for ultra-wideband high-voltage balloons, which actually would be related to subject number one that we decided, that we discussed before. And this is the research paper by trying to load it, that data. Gerald Bauhammer, Philips Laboratory, 1994. Should be easy one. I'm glad that I found something for you to think, because I thought, Dick, that there is no antenna in the whole world that you will not have immediate answer for. Back to you, Dick.
It's nice that you have that impression. And I may have worked on a lot of antennas, but there may be 5,000 kinds of antennas and another 5,000 kind of inverse antennas because of Babinet's rule. And I certainly haven't worked on 5,000 antennas. And the rate at which antennas are being patented is extremely high. I mean, my name is on 25 patent applications in the last 9 years, and some of them have already been issued. Antennas are being invented at a ridiculously high rate. So you may think I have familiarity with a lot of antennas. Well, there's a lot of them I don't have familiarity with. And so this particular balloon antenna I'm not familiar with. And the diagrams are not enough to give me a picture of the whole thing. They're only little pieces of diagram, and they want you to put it together. It was clear in the guy's mind who wrote the diagrams, and he made the assumption that everyone else will see it the same way he sees it, and I don't get it yet. I may have to go to his earlier references to figure out exactly what he's trying to picture there.
I thought, and I stated in...
The time is 12 o'clock a.m.
I stated in the top of my email, you're going to like it, this
emergency power.
What was that, John?
I had a power outage, Dick. I just had to switch to emergency power. I'm operating on emergency power right now.
In other words, you're on your own generator, and your section of Staten Island or Richmond... You're on battery backup. I thought you were on your own generator because your house was no longer being powered by Con Ed. That's what I thought you were saying. Okay. Your battery power is good for how long, John?
Last time I checked, it was 12 hours.
Okay. I think we'll be through before then, John. Go ahead.
KC2QAQ? I hope so, Dick. Although it's interesting. Glenn recognized. Go ahead, Glenn, pick it up.
Yeah, I just had a quick question for Dick. Do you have a description of what a balloon antenna is, or what, you know, the final outcome of this type of antenna is? I'm not familiar with the term balloon antenna.
We're probably mispronouncing it. It's a combination of balloon plus antenna, and he calls it a balloon antenna. And it has some of the properties of a conical turnstile, but there's a little bit more structure to it than that, and from the diagrams, it's not easy to figure out what he's done. He's got a mixture of ferrite and a pair of turnstiles all coming together in a funny way, all being fed by one piece of coax. And he calls the coax a wormhole feed. So it's got a lot of unusual properties. He claims it's got more than one phase center. He doesn't talk about what polarization it's emitting. He doesn't say it's emitting a circular polarized wave or a planar wave. And his diagrams are partial diagrams, and you have to try to put in all the missing information. So it could be a lot clearer. Back to you, Glenn.
That isn't great either.
Is the ferrite part of the, like, antenna elements, or is somehow the ferrite attached to, like, some kind of, like, coaxial, you know, feed point feeding type of arrangement?
What little I can gather, he has started off with a ferrite washer. The ferrite washer has greater thickness at the perimeter than it does at the center. and on the forward surface of the washer he has laid some conical elements, and I